So let us go on, continuing to read from Nyasagadatta, and we'll continue with the conversation that he was conducting yesterday. And the questioner asks, what is the difference between happiness and pleasure? And Nyasagadatta says that pleasure depends on things. Happiness does not. When we look at the expressions that surround these two, happiness and pleasure, we get pleasure, or we give pleasure, or we receive pleasure, or pleasure comes to us. We never say that we are pleasure, and yet we say we are happy. And this indicates immediately the vast difference between the two. Modern psychological theory is somewhat dominated by the notion of what they call the pleasure-pain principle. And that is that we simply seek pleasure and avoid pain. And the belief is that that is universally true. And why it is, to a large extent, the case, the inference that is drawn by psychologists that only pleasure and pain are really the great motivators is misguided. Happiness is a bit like silence, or you can use the metaphor of silence in order to understand happiness. Perhaps it's a better way of putting it. Silence is always there, or here. Noise does not overcome silence. When there is noise, silence does not disappear. Because we are more attentive to changes in experience than experience which is consistent, we tend to notice silence more strikingly, as sounds more strikingly. We tend to ignore silence. And yet, silence is really the rejuvenator. And in the same way, happiness is always present. There were some people in Doksan yesterday that were still having difficulty with this idea. Pain does not do away with happiness in the same way that sounds do not do away with silence. It may be more evident. And, of course, we can ignore the truth that we are fundamentally happy. It seems strange that we should do this when most people claim that their wish in life is to be happy. But we've said many times that people treasure their pain because their pain gives them a sense of being. It gives them a sense of being separate. And in their pain, they find a kind of perverse uniqueness. And so as a consequence, people say, but my life is painful, because they cannot give up their pain and sink into the happiness which is their true nature. In the Hindu tradition, there is what is called Chitsat Ananda, and that could be translated in the language that we use as knowing, being, and happiness. Ananda is variously translated and often it's used, the word bliss is used instead of happiness. But the reason for emphasizing this is because so much of our attention is directed towards pleasure, believing that pleasure and happiness are more or less synonymous, when in fact they are vastly different. One thing about pleasure is that it can easily turn to pain. For example, one has a great pleasure at getting a new job, or finding a new partner, or buying a new house. But then we find that the boss at the work is something of a tyrant, that the person that we felt we could rely on turns out to betray us. The house turns out to have weak foundations. And so what was the source of pleasure turns rapidly to the source of pain and displeasure. But happiness cannot turn into unhappiness. Unhappiness is this various kinds of pain, various kinds of suffering, which come from primarily the search to be unique. The questioner asks again, if happiness is independent, why are we not always happy? And then, as Nyasagadatta says, as long as we believe that we need things to make us happy, we shall also believe that in their absence we must be miserable. We talked about the power of imagination, and we could imagine that having a lot of money could in fact give us a great deal of pleasure, could give us indeed a great deal of happiness. And we can dwell in our imagination on the benefits that money could provide. And because we dwell on those benefits that we could get out of the money, or because we can dwell on the benefits that we could get if we could find a fine relationship, or because if we could find a fine job, or whatever, because we can dwell on the imagined benefits that would come from that, the life that we're living loses whatever reality that it has. We see it against the glow of what is possible. What is possible has a certain sheen about it, a certain shine. Possibly you've had this experience when you've looked forward to going away on holiday, and in prospect, it seems wonderful. And yet when you get there, the hotel room is very dark, the bathroom doesn't work quite as well as it ought to, the receptionist was very sour when you got, and so on. But nevertheless, we have that ability to project a certain kind of glow around what is possible. And because we do that, then we look at our lives and we say our lives are miserable because they lack that glow. Actually, as you possibly know, people who win these vast sums of money run into all kinds of difficulties. Very often they get into drugs, they get members of their family kidnapped. There's all kinds of, there was a guy in Detroit, if you believe this, a guy in Detroit, he won a lottery, and it was so overwhelming that he had a nervous breakdown. Anyway, he recovered from the nervous breakdown, and he took out another lottery ticket, and damn it if he didn't win again. Some people never learn. As long as we believe that we need things to make us happy, we shall also believe that in their absence we must be miserable. It's the must which is the operative word there. If any of you have been in a state of great poverty, you'll know that it isn't at all a life of great misery. This person spent a year on a farm in northern Transvaal. We had nothing. We didn't have a telephone, car. We didn't even have a kitchen. Jean cooked on a fire outside. And yet, there's, without any doubt, the two of us always say that that was some of the best times of our lives. We just lived as close as you could get to nature. And we both look back on it with an immense amount of nostalgia. Mind always shapes itself according to its beliefs. This is interesting. This is how it is. We tend to think that beliefs are, well, things that, you know, we have and we could easily change our beliefs. But it isn't like that at all. The way that we believe is the way the world is. There isn't the world, and in addition to that, we have beliefs. We were talking about yesterday about the world, which is really being the world situation. And the world situation is framed by our beliefs. And this world that we see is the world as it is. Not as we believe it to be. Other people have beliefs. We have a world. And to change a belief is to change a world. One of the great things these days is the big debate between the creationists and the evolutionists. And the evolutionists can't understand why the creationists just don't accept what is so obvious. It's so obvious. There's so much evidence in favor of evolution. These people are just obdurate, stupid, or just whatever. But for a creationist to accept evolution, he would have to let his own world crumble. He would have to see his own world destroyed in order that another world could be resurrected out of it. And this is too much, too high a price to pay, particularly for what the evolutionists have to offer, by the way. It's the same with the when this guy came up with the idea that the Earth isn't the centre of the universe. It wasn't a question, well, this is the truth, look through the telescope and you'll see it. Because when they looked through the telescope, they would have seen their whole world crumbling, not another star or whatever it was he was supposed to look at. And it is when we are working in Zazen and we have to work, these thoughts that flit in and flit out, these are not important. The thoughts that are problematic are the beliefs that we have that this is how the world is. And as we sit and we allow whatever is to come up, eventually we'll see how this sort of tension that comes up out of the very contradictory ways that we have, the beliefs that we have, which are framing our world. And it's because the beliefs are so contradictory that we live in such a chaotic state. He says, mind always shapes itself according to its belief, and the world is shaped according to the beliefs. Hence the importance of convincing oneself that one need not be prodded into happiness. It's not really a question of convincing ourselves. The subject of pleasure and happiness could very well be a subject sometime for meditation. You know what we say, meditation is taking an idea such as what is the difference between pleasure and happiness. And just allowing that question to circle in the mind. I wouldn't suggest you do it on Sesshin, but it is something that when one's at home, one could easily pick up as a meditative subject. Because being able to distinguish between these two gives one a different orientation towards the practice. If we can see, truly see, that happiness is our true nature, that there's being, there's knowing, and there's feeling, and the fundamental feeling is, well, if you like to call it bliss or peace or love or happiness, these are all ways by which we give a form to this formless, which is the basic feeling. And if we can see that this peace or love or happiness is fundamental, it is, so to say, then we'll be less inclined to be reaching out. This reaching out that we do when we say, ask the question, for example, who am I? Comes from this habitual reaching out that we have. Our life is a constant reaching out. And this reaching out for pleasure, reaching out for that sense of absolute being, which is one of the main motivators, really, the search for uniqueness or absolute being or absolute perfection. All of these are also ways of trying to give expression to something which is beyond expression also. But we are reaching out all the time. We've got the myths of Shangri-La, of the Grail, of the croc at the end of the rainbow, of Moby Dick. These myths of reaching out towards the ultimate. And it's habitual in us, when we want the ultimate, to reach out for the ultimate, for the mind to extend itself, to try to get beyond itself in order to realize this absoluteness or this uniqueness or this perfection or whatever it might be. And if we can see that happiness is already present, that we are, that being is being happy, that knowing is knowing happiness, that being and knowing and happiness are one. They come out of one common source which lies beyond it all. Then we'll be more inclined to allow what is to come up, what is to show itself, to open itself, to reveal itself. And although initially it reveals itself in a sort of painful way because of the contradictory and conflicting thoughts and beliefs that we have, it shows itself in that painful, difficult way. We get a lot of tension and dryness and so on. Although that is the case, nevertheless, if we are sensitive, if we can have a sensitive, a subtle, an intimate practice, then seeping through it will be the realization of this being, this love. Hence the importance of convincing oneself that one need not be prodded into happiness. We do not have to get happiness. That, on the contrary, pleasure is a distraction and a nuisance, for it merely increases the false conviction that one needs to have and do things to be happy, where in reality it is just the opposite. This do things. There's a kind of frenetic quality that some people's lives have. They've always got to do things. And again, it comes from that same search for that taste of the absolute, the taste of the unique. It very often manifests itself as the taste of being important, of people giving one special regard, special praise and admiration. Again, we're not saying that we should sit and do nothing. This is not it at all. No, no, no. We must be involved. Being involved, expressing oneself one way or another, is life. But instead of being doing things in order to get that special taste, in order to get that pleasure, in order to get that kind of feedback, which is really bittersweet. It's always bittersweet. The admiration that one gets from others is always bittersweet, because tinged always with that admiration that one gets from others is envy. And so instead of going after that acclaim, that need for importance or whatever it might be, admiration, celebrity, fame, and all the rest of it, one does things for the sheer joy of doing them. There's a pleasure in being able to exercise our talents, a natural pleasure. One sees it even in, you see a bird flying, and it's flying obviously out of sheer pleasure. It wheeling around in the sky, it dips and it jumps. It's the same, we sit and watch a squirrel in the tree outside our apartment. And it leaps from branch to branch, and it swings there, and then it scampers down and scampers up. It's just thoroughly enjoying the movement. It's doing something, and it's thoroughly enjoying the doing of it. And almost anything, if one gives one's attention to the doing of it, and not the meaning of it or the end product of it, almost anything that one does is pleasurable. What greater pleasure, for example, is there than just walking round the block? So this need to do, and also it doesn't mean to say that one has to live a life of poverty and not having anything and so on. On the contrary, there's nothing wrong with being comfortable and having things that give you comfort and so on. There's not, or even things that give you pleasure. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem is when the comfort becomes the prime motivator, when that becomes the reason for doing or having or being, then one is living outside oneself. One's living separate from oneself. And then he says, but why talk of happiness at all? You do not think of happiness except when you're unhappy. And this is how it is. We ignore it as a rule. And the only reason that this person is sort of bringing this to your attention is because we have spent a lot of time talking about suffering and so on. And it did seem that we must remind you of this other truth as well. The only way by which we can find ultimate stability is by passing through the fire. There's no question about it. But the direction to go in passing through the fire is what is important. And if you think you have to pass through the fire outwards to get something outside, then this is a wrong direction. A person who says, now I am happy, is between two sorrows, past and future. This happiness is mere excitement caused by relief from pain. Real happiness is utterly unselfconscious. And this is why we say that awakening, an awakened person doesn't know they're awakened. Awakening and happiness are the same. One comes home to one's ultimate happiness. But that doesn't mean to say that one walks around on a sort of a pink cloud in a state of blissful existence. One gets on with life. One gets involved. One does things. One works. But the working, the doing, the being with other people is no longer sort of end-oriented. It is no longer in order that. One does it out of the sheer fact of doing it. And as he says, it is best expressed as negatively. There is nothing wrong with me. This change of way of seeing the world, one no longer sees the world as over there. That doesn't mean to say that, again, one walks around seeing the world as one. It is that one no longer sees the world as over there. One doesn't have to have a positive simply because one lets go of a negative. When you let go of a negative, then you come home to what you are. It's like, you're right, you're sick. And so then you get well. But wellness you don't look upon as a positive. Wellness you look upon as the natural state. He says, there is nothing wrong with me. I have nothing to worry about. One way in which we try to put this very often is that everything fundamentally is okay. And this truly is the case. Sometimes it may even be as well just to remind oneself of this truth. That to see that fundamentally everything is okay. It really is. In spite of the appearances of the moment, because these appearances of the moment will change. Everything changes, everything moves, everything goes on its way, except the truth that fundamentally everything is okay. I have nothing to worry about. He says, after all, the ultimate purpose of all practice is to reach a point when this conviction, that is, I have nothing to worry about, instead of being only verbal, is based on the actual and ever-present experience. And again, it's just an awkward way of expression, and it will do, but again, we don't experience it. It is the basis of experience. The basis of most people's experience at the moment, experience, not being, the basis of most people's experience at the moment is division, is separation, is conflict. That in all experience, there is a conflicting element. And this is why whatever one does, one never feels that this is really what one wants to do. If one is with people, one feels, well, I wish I was alone. And if one's alone, one wishes one was with people. And so it goes. Because there is this fundamental conflict, there is this wound, we are wounded in our being, if you like. And when one lets down, when one comes home, the experience has no longer got that split in it. There is no longer the sense, as we say, that the world is over there, which comes out of this split. He says it's based on the ever and actual present experience. And then the question says, well, what experience is that? And Nisargadatta says, the experience of being empty, uncluttered by memories and expectations. Again, it's unfortunate that he uses the word experience, but it's very difficult to talk without using it. But it is a condition of emptiness. It is the basis of the experience is based on emptiness. It's the condition of experience. The idea of things, the sense of the reality of the world, the thingness of the world, the thingness of things, comes from this separation, from this conflict. The belief that the world is real is because we experience the world across this conflict. And when we get beyond or upstream, actually, of that conflict, then instead of the experience having the condition of that kind of thingness, of the reality of things, and everything being separate and itself, it is the condition is a condition of emptiness. And as he says, uncluttered by memories and expectations. Again, it's not that we no longer have memories. It's not that at all. But we're no longer searching in the past in terms of regret or in terms of remorse and so on. We're no longer looking at what was and wishing for one reason or another that it were otherwise. And he says it's uncluttered by expectations. And as you know, the word expectation means to look outside. That's ex and spectatare. As I say, that's one little bit of Latin I still remember. Discipuli pictorum spectate, which the student looks at the picture. Marvellous what education can do for people, isn't it? He says, the experience of being empty, uncluttered by memories and expectations. It is like the happiness of open spaces, of being young, of having all the time and energy for doing things, for discovery and for adventure. That's lovely. But it is what he's talking about now is that openness, that life becomes a creative possibility. Life is a creative possibility. But because we are conflicted, then it becomes a conflicting possibility. Instead of seeing that the conflict is the basis for creativity, for going beyond, that we need conflict, we need opposition, we need difficulty in order to achieve anything. We need some kind of opposition. But we don't mean by that we need an enemy. And when we talk about conflict, we don't necessarily mean to say a violent in terms of violence. When we do work, work needs some conflicting situations. We need a certain dissonance in order to be able to transcend that dissonance in a new way. And life is constantly the encounter with dissonance, the encounter with difficulty, the encounter with opposition and so on, and being able to transcend it. And this is why we say that one must love the difficulty of practice, the pain of practice, the difficulties that seem to be so obstructive. This is the dissonance that I speak of. And if one faces that, if one comes right to be one with it, then it opens up this creative power that is your essential being. It is that is the feeling of being alive. If you've ever played sport, you know what exhilaration can come from being a member of the team and using one's abilities to overcome the opposition of the other side. And you don't have to fight them. It can be perfectly amiable. In fact, it must be amiable. But nevertheless, there is that struggle, that overcoming. And so that is an aspect of existence which is vital to a real existence. Then the question says, what remains to discover? This is the sort of feeling that many people have, that when one comes to awakening, one sort of sits on a cloud or something, that everything stops, that it's all over, it's all done with. But on the contrary, one's just beginning. What remains to discover? And Nisargadatta says, the university without and immensity within, as they are in reality, in the great mind and heart of God. And there it is, that creative discovery. One may do it in terms of relationships with other people, or one may do it in terms of some kind of interest, some intellectual interest even. But it means that one is using one's vitality in an open way, not in a way to close and to obstruct and to secure and to hedge in. There's no need to look for security. Your true nature is the ultimate in security. Nothing can affect it fundamentally. Nothing. He goes on, he says, the universe without and the immensity within as they are in reality, in the great mind and heart of God, the meaning and purpose of existence, the secret of suffering, life's redemption from ignorance. All of this is open. And another person may see it and say something quite different. This is just Nisargadatta's way of trying to express the openness of what is possible. In traditional spirituality, it's often said that people live in prison. And really what Nisargadatta is talking about is breaking out from prison. Most people are prisoners. They are prisoners of their beliefs. They're prisoners of this sense of the only way to be is to be closed in on a sense of uniqueness. It's a kind of cocoon attitude towards existence, and the cocoon itself becomes the prison. But it's the prison of one's own beliefs, that this is the only way that I can be. And as we say, it's not a question of changing beliefs, but changing the world. This is why we have to die in order to be reborn. It's all our beliefs that have to die. And one of the ways in which one can see one's beliefs challenged is when one is hurt by people. When you are hurt, other aspect of your fundamental beliefs have been challenged. You can see what is happening at the moment with the Muslims, that eventually the encroachment of Western civilization is challenging their fundamental beliefs. They've been locked in these beliefs for centuries. And now the whole way the world is going is eroding those beliefs. And you can see the violence that it is generating in some of the people, even to the point that they destroy themselves in the name of their beliefs. It's a strange paradox, but nevertheless you can see it is the case. But they're not exceptional. It's maybe the degree to which they're going is exceptional, but they're like everyone. They're like all of us. In one way or another, we destroy ourselves in the preservation of our beliefs. And then the question says, if being happy is the same as being free from fear and worry, cannot it be said that the absence of trouble is the cause of happiness? And then Nisargadatta says, a state of absence or non-existence cannot be a cause. The pre-existence of a cause is implied in the notion. He says, your natural state in which nothing exists cannot be a cause of becoming. Your natural state is empty. Your natural state is complete. The causes are hidden in the great mysterious power of memory. But your true home is in emptiness of all content. This mysterious power of memory. As you know, the theosophists have the notion of the Akashic records, and the sutra that Bodhidharma brought. Anyway. Yeah, Lankavatara, thank you. The Lankavatara Sutra, it has the notion of the Alaya and the Alaya Vijnana. And this is the notion that there is a sort of a seed bed of memory. And when the occasion is ripe, these memories spring up and produce a certain kind of fruit. And there's a lot in this. There's a lot that we don't understand. This is why he calls it a mysterious power and perhaps it isn't really something we can understand. But you must understand that awareness is not personal. It is not my awareness. The personal grows out of awareness. It's like awareness is like a stream. And the stream produces little whirlpools as a consequence of friction. And those whirlpools then take on a life of their own. When the circumstances change, the whirlpools merge back into the stream as a whole. And you could say that the whirlpool dies. But it doesn't die, it simply changes its form. And each one of us, this sense of me, this is not the sense of I, it's a sense of me, is like a whirlpool. And each being, each sentient being, is a little whirlpool in this vast river of existence. And this is pure speculation now. It would seem that within that great river of existence are the memories of everything that has ever happened. But in any case, what he's saying is that come home to yourself. In doing that, you are no longer closed off in yourself. And because you are no longer closed in on yourself, and that means you're no longer trying to feed a kind of dead part of yourself, you're no longer giving over all of your attention to nourishing that inanimate aspect of yourself in terms of pleasure, in terms of congratulations, in terms of fame, in terms of admiration. You're no longer trying to feed this dead king or queen that lies in the very heart of you. And because you're no longer spending all of your time feeding this, it's possible to open up into a new way, into a new, totally creative way. And life really then is lovely. And every day really is a good day.